When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What is up, everybody? Welcome to Comic Book Club. I'm Alex, and we are still on the con floor of New York Comic Con at Artist Alley, and we are sitting here talking to amazing creator, one of our favorite creators of one of our favorite current books, Patrick Horvath. Patrick, great chatting with you again.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, my gosh. So since we last talked, and we talked when the book was still in process. I don't remember which issue you came on the show. It was like 3, 4, something like that.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
This is an enormous hit. It was already an enormous hit, but every issue sold more than the last. I think we knew that already. But then there was, and we talk about this on our Comic Book Club news podcast a little bit, but ICV2 put up their list of trade bestsellers, and the trade just came out, and this was number 2 after Ultimate Spider-Man.
Yeah.
That's bananas.
Yeah. Yes. Correct.
Correct.
That is bananas. That was nuts.
Well, so, I mean, not to put you on the spot, and I don't know if you know, I haven't an answer to this, but what do you attribute that to? Why are people responding to this book so hard?
I mean, I feel like we had it was the right book to have at a very specific time, and we just caught a wave.
Yeah.
And I feel like I mean, obviously, the book is resonating with people, and that's terrific. I feel like all the groundwork laid with the evolution of, like, creator-owned stuff over the past decade prior really, like, primed everything for, you know, for this book to kind of have an audience ready to jump on it. I feel like, well, as a for instance, like, you know, something like Stray Dogs coming out. And I feel like, you know, I've said it many times, but the Venn diagram of fans for that book and my book is almost a complete circle, it feels like, just from the amount of folks that are looking for something that is, it's cute and it's also sweet, but it's also horribly disturbing and strangely, you know, upsetting in ways they maybe didn't think it was going to be when they started reading it, but then also has an emotional core to it that they weren't expecting either. I think a lot of the time, horror can devolve into sort of a flippancy with human life, or just life, and you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I feel like that's something I don't respond to necessarily, and I feel like having a book like this come out caught people off guard in, like, a couple of different ways.
Yeah.
And then the word of mouth went nuts on this book. The amount of hand-selling that was happening in shops just blew me away. Even with, like, just, you know, customers in store telling other customers, even, while they were standing in line talking about stuff. And so it's like all that weird stuff, and the fact that it seems like such a wrong thing to do with these cute animals that I do in this book, and they're just like, well, people I think will at least be curious enough to give it a look if they're at all interested, right? And then once they do read through it, I think they kind of see like there's more going on to the book than just the serial killer bear thing. Like there's a lot of strange, you know, exploration of, like, interior lives that happens and grief that happens, having, like, existential midlife crisis that happens and stuff like that. So it's, you know, I think it's just all that kind of stuff wrapped in there. And it was, you know, and again, I just happened to have that book that was doing that at the time.
I don't think I actually said the title of the book, Beneath the Trees Where Nobody Sees.
Right, yes.
In case I didn't, if anybody doesn't know what we're talking about, that's what we're talking about here. Just to stay on this, and then I want to talk about the next thing, the big thing that we're going to mainly talk about. Samantha, though, is the main character. She's not good. She kills people.
Yeah. And not a cool way, yeah.
So why do you think people identify with that? I mean, just pivoting off of you talking
totally
about, like, the emotional core.
Because, I mean, like, we're in full spoiler territory here.
Yeah.
So, like, the thing that's interesting is that, like, technically, Samantha's, like, the worst
right.
person in the whole book. And you have Nigel, who's like this, you know, Nigel comes up as the actual, you know, the other killer in town, who sort of holds her in high regard and has these notions of, like, emulating what she does. And the thing of it is, though, is that, like, he's very messy and he's sort of chaotic and she's very orderly. But, like, technically, she's killed, like, dozens and dozens of people and he's, like, killed a handful.
Mm-hmm.
And has actually, like, kind of brought to light, like, what she's been doing. Like, arguably is actually, like, a chaotic force for maybe finally bringing her to some sort of, you know, accountability, right? And instead, everybody's rooting for her to, like, get away with, like, getting rid of Nigel and, like, you know, hiding what she's been up to. And it was such an interesting, to me, that was the interesting challenge of, like, how to take a character like that, that should, by all accounts, be a total villain, and instead have everyone rooting for her to kind of put, you know, the world as she knows it back in order.
Yeah.
And it felt like the things I really leaned on were having that chaos versus order. And having that, it's honestly the type of thing where I feel like everybody can relate to having the rug pulled out from under you from mm-hmm. something that you didn't even think was going to be an issue, and then having it get way out of control, and then, you know, and then the relief that comes from setting those things straight. And so I feel like that, honestly, like that weird relatability was my endpoint to, like, having that, you know, connection with readers. So yeah, it's totally fascinating to me that it worked.
Right. because in Samantha's case, her orderly nature is impunity to kill people whenever
yes,
she wants.
It's very, it very much comes from efficiency and, yeah. like, for her ability to, like, the random quality of it is 100% just to not get caught. Like, it's, you know, and there's really nothing, yeah, there's no, like, nothing righteous about what she's doing. Like, it's very bad.
Yeah.
Again, before we get to the thing you're talking about, I just want to mention you did a prequel
right.
for San Diego Comic-Con that sort of wove into some of the things that we got to see in the book. Talk about that a little bit. What happens in the prequel?
So the prequel is essentially the first time Sam acts on these urges that she's had for a long time. And it finds her 20 years prior to the start of the events and the, you know, Beneath the Trees. And she's, like, fresh out of college, backpacking in Germany, trying to find herself, basically. And then comes upon the scenario that, like, kind of catches her, you know, it catches her by surprise. And then she finally, like, decides, like, well, if I'm going to do this, like, I might, here's the time to do it.
Yeah.
And that's basically what the ash can is.
And that would be great if you ended there, but you're not ending there.
No, I'm not.
We're taping this a little bit before, but this is coming out afterwards, after the big announcement here at New York Comic Con. There's going to be a sequel series.
Yes, there is. We're doing another book.
That's wild. Yeah. What can you tell about this? The title is Beneath the Trees Where Nobody Sees, Rite of Spring.
Correct. Right? Yeah, Rite of Spring. The book is going to take place. I really wanted to have a setting for it that was going to make a really interesting evolution off of the first book. So this book's going to be set around, like, 8 years after the book we just read. And in that time in between, now that we catch up with many of the characters that survived, like, the first book, and we see, like, how the last 8 years has affected them, the repercussions of stuff that's happened with the first book, and then also, like, psychologically beyond just, like, regular sort of, you know, day-to-day nuts and bolts stuff. And then also, it's going to show, like, if the first book was the 80s, this is essentially the 90s now.
Ooh,
the internet's a thing now.
Okay.
Corporate land development for, like, urban sprawl's happening. It's the wooded areas that she really liked are becoming smaller and fewer, right?
Yeah.
So she's feeling this weird, like, she's feeling the world getting smaller.
Mm.
And then also, there's going to be an element from her past that's going to show up and kind of, it makes her kind of reassess a lot of what she's been up to, and then she's going to take, like, a real interesting angle on it. And that's pretty much what I'll say about that.
All right. Well, you touched on this a little bit, but if the first one is kind of about chaos versus order, what's the thematic thing you're dealing with
there? Oh, this one's very much like, this one is very much about what I would call, like, a modern era moving into a future era, and then her feeling like
she's losing her place in it.
Oh, yeah. It's, you know, modern versus future, and she's feels the crunch. Like, she feels like she's losing her place in it.
Rite of Spring certainly implies a couple of potential things, time of year, potentially some sort of rituals as well.
Yes, right.
What can we take away from that?
I mean, sacrifice is a really interesting theme that's going to come up in it.
Okay.
And then also that Rite of Spring, like the Stravinsky Rite of Spring, very much like involves sacrifice. And it obviously has like pagan connotations. There's also like the second act of the, I don't know if it's the act, but the second part of Rite of Spring that literally has like the like if you see the performance, like the dancers in bear outfits that show up. When they have the young woman that's being used as, you know, the sacrifice. And then also, you know, bears come out of hibernation in spring, and it felt like such a fitting setting for, like, the, for this story to take place. Also, you know, that initial book was essentially set in October, and it felt like an interesting, like, the autumnal equinox, and now we're coming into like a vernal equinox, and it felt like an interesting place to start this story.
What's it like for you as a creator, as a writer, artist, returning to this world again? What did you learn, and how do you challenge yourself?
I mean, the big thing that was awesome to me about it was just that, like, well, listen, anybody worth their salt's gonna take an opportunity of doing a limited series as a possibility that it might be ongoing. Like, if you're listening to this, you're thinking about making comics, if you're ever given the opportunity to do a series, like, sew it up nice, but leave room to grow.
Yeah.
Because you're going to do yourself a favor. So with this, it's mostly like, I'm super thrilled that it panned out, and that I do get to do, like, after issue one, I was immediately like, oh, this, I could totally see where I could take this. And so I was already having a lot of ideas of, like, what I wanted to do if I ever got the chance to do more. Challenges-wise is that, like, the first book was 100% felt like it had the benefit of just catching people off guard.
Yeah.
And now people know what to expect. And you run the risk of playing the hits versus doing something interesting with it. And the one thing I would say with that first book, it was incredibly encouraging to get as weird as I wanted to get with it and to have people respond really well.
Yeah.
And so I think it's going to be fighting the urge to do whatever I do know worked well in the first book and, like, maybe leaving that little island of safety for something more undiscovered that I'm not sure how it's going to land, but I'm feeling drawn to do. And I think that's going to be the big challenge for me.
Since the inside covers or parts of the book were newspapers in the first,
yeah,
we're jumping forward to the 90s. Are we going to get web pages this time?
We're still working it out, but
okay,
that's entirely possible.
One other part of this, though, is this is, I don't know if this is exactly true or you agree with the statement, but IDW's kind of building a line around you in a certain way with IDW Dark.
Yeah.
How does that feel? Good.
It feels super fun. Like, it feels fun to have a little home to work and put these books out in. I really didn't anticipate, a future of this thing as I was making it. As soon as, like, by, like, book issue two of the first book, like, it was, I mean, it seemed pretty apparent. I was like, well, I think we're going to do more. Like, it would be crazy to not do more. And then it finally became a formality, and then we just started talking, what would that book be? And then the new format and everything is going to be, like, awesome. I'm very excited to have, like, longer format issues. And the fact that it's going to be three longer format, it's going to make it, like, I just, as myself as a writer, I'm always, like, a three-act fella. Mm-hmm. So, like, it lends itself perfectly for that type of thing. Even the first book, to be honest, with three acts, like issues two, issue, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 and 6, and I basically treated each chunk as like an act.
I don't know if this is getting too niche, but is it going to have a different trim size? Is it going to be larger at all, or
I think it's going to be same size, and it's just going to be, as far as I understand it, and then it's just going to be longer format, like basically double issue.
Gotcha. Before I let you go, that's a lot of awesome news. Anything else you want to plug?
We also have the book that I self-published digitally called Free for All back in 2020 is finally was fulfilled on a Zoop campaign. The printing for that's coming out imminently. And then based off of that campaign, Oni reached out. And then they had asked if there was any future for that book that I had planned. And I was like, I mean, I don't, I'm just printing it and then we're done with it.
Yeah.
And they were like, would you like to put it out with us? And I was like, yes, I would. So, Oni's putting out the book and I believe they just made the announcement on Wednesday. So, so it's coming out, I believe March, 2025. And it's just, it's going to be the one shot story. It's like a graphic novella. And I'm super excited that Oni's going to give it a home after we fulfill it with all of the awesome people that supported it on Zoom.
That's very awesome. Patrick, congratulations on everything.
Thank you so much.
I'm excited and terrified to read the next series.
I'm excellent. I'm glad to hear that.
And if you'd like to support our podcast, patreon.com/comicbookclub. Also, we do a live show every Tuesday night at 7 p.m. to Facebook and YouTube. Come hang out. We would love to chat with you about comic books. Apple, Spotify, Android, or the app of your choice. To subscribe, listen, and follow the show at Comic Book Live on Twitter/X, Comic Book Club Live on TikTok and Instagram, comicbookclublive.com for this podcast and many more. Until next time, we'll see you at the Comic Book Club.
Of the veil.